I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back for another Saturday stream, and I am very happy to have a friend and frequent now. He's now a frequent guest, American Krogan. Krogan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Well, I figure that since this is the 4th of July weekend, I would get somebody who's a fellow American and who's more American than somebody who actually goes by American Krogan. And so I have also been noticing that you've been really on fire in your various social media posts recently. So I just thought it would be enjoyable to talk to you. And being both Americans, you know, we can have some thoughts about the 4th of July and American independence and American identity and so forth. So I thought this would be a good conversation. So, but tell us, what have you been occupied with recently? Have you been doing a new video, for instance?
Yeah, I guess I haven't. I announced it on Subscribestar, but I don't think I announced it publicly. I talked about it a little bit with Tim Murdoch on White Rabbit Radio the other day. Basically, I'm working on a video about, pull it up because the title is a little weird. It's called The Report of the Joint Special Committee to Investigate Chinese Immigration. This report was printed in 1877, and it's a joint House-Senate committee to investigate Chinese immigration, you know, around the time following the Civil War. And it's a 1,200-page report. And it's basically a series of minutes from a series of interviews in San Francisco with a whole bunch of different people, like police officers, police chiefs, health officials, immigration officials, people who worked within shipping, various experts, legal experts, lawyers, you know, so on and so forth. And yeah, it's very interesting stuff because it highlights how a lot of the arguments that we hear today surrounding like civic nationalist type attitudes toward immigration, they all date back to things that you can find within this report. And there's a lot of other interesting stuff in there, like a lot of Chinese stereotypes, you know, negative stereotypes are reinforced in there. And, you know, I never really like speaking pejoratively about other groups of people, but I think in some of these situations, we have to talk about what results from, you know, certain groups of people immigrating into another group of people's territory. And, you know, the Chinese do have a tendency, if you step outside of their metropolitan urban areas, they have this tendency to be a little bit more third world. They don't have really great hygienic practices. And you see a lot of that in this report. I guess I could go on, but that's basically what I'm working on at the moment.
I think that's very interesting. The Chinese Exclusion Acts in the 19th century are actually very, very fascinating. We have a few articles up at Countercurrents actually about these. And when I was editing the Occidental Quarterly, the late Raymond Wolters also wrote a very, very good review essay on a couple of books about Chinese exclusion movement. It was really a working class movement primarily, and it was to close off the United States from China's endless population. It was enormous then. Of course, it's far, far bigger today because these people were being brought in by railroad barons primarily to undercut white laborers to pay lower wages. And it was a wonderful example of working class solidarity and radical politics working to create immigration restrictions, basically. So I think it's an absolutely fascinating chapter in American history. And there were similar chapters in the history of Australia and New Zealand and Canada, too.
Yeah, one of the things that's great about this report is that the white men in government, the white men conducting the report, they have a very pro-white, pro-nativist stance. And often when they interview railroad barons such as Charles Crocker and other people who try to make these various disingenuous arguments for continuing Chinese immigration, they take them to task. And it's just very refreshing to go back and read that and just see that, you know, once upon a time we had leaders and we had men in government, very intelligent, very talented, very articulate men who took our side. And it would just be wonderful if we had those type of men in charge again today.
Yeah, it's wonderful when people come at you with claims like, we'll never be able to do something like this, to show them, well, actually, we already have. We already have in America. And then they'll say, oh, we couldn't have this without some horrible totalitarian jack, blah, blah, blah. No, we actually had it in an America that's far freer than the liberal democracy that we've declined into today. So history is wonderful because history shows you that things that may seem impossible were actually real at one time or another.
Yeah, this is, you know, I often hear when I talk about the repatriation of various peoples who are now, who now find themselves within the United States, I hear these arguments like, well, they won't want to leave. And if they won't want to leave, you can't force them to leave because that's immoral. And it's like people come up with all these really bizarre ideas. And it's like what I immediately thought of recently was Detroit in the great Black Northern migration. You know, Detroit in the 1940s was overwhelmingly white. And now it's a very, very Black city. And it didn't take massive amounts of bloodshed for Blacks to take over Detroit. It was a series of incentives and economic policies and so on and so forth that did that. And I see no reason why we can't do that in reverse.
One of my articles that I'm most pleased with is the piece that I put out originally under the title, The Slow Cleanse. It's in the White Nationalist Manifesto under the more moderate title, Restoring White Homelands. And it just makes that point. It took decades for us to get into this horrible situation, and it will take perhaps decades to get us out. The only thing we need to do, though, now, today, is to institute different trends that incentivize these populations not to come, but to leave. If we put incentives in place for these people to leave, they will slowly leave, and then we will have our homelands back. These people didn't come here through some strange natural phenomenon. Right. They came here because of laws and incentives that were put in place. And those laws and incentives can be removed. And we know that they came here because of laws and incentives, because if you look at the history of America, you see these incentives and laws rising and falling. You see the incentives to bring the Chinese in. You see the laws stopping them. Also, one of the things that's very interesting about America in the 19th century is very large numbers of immigrants went home. They repatriated. If they didn't like it here, they repatriated. It was possible to make these people go back. And it's possible to make them go back again today.
Yeah, I don't really have any follow-up thoughts on that. I think that's well said, and I very much agree. I guess, you know, the really most important thing is I think we just have to have the will to pursue these policies. And what I see often is a lot of people within the larger right-wing sphere, even within the dissident right, I just see people embracing these bizarre moral arguments that, you know, I see a lot of people saying, well, African-Americans, you know, they have more in common with us than they do Africans and so on and so forth because they speak English and, you know, they have no, the culture that they now have is very far removed from Africa. Just all these bizarre arguments. And it's just like, you know, we just have to have the will. We have to have the will to stand up exactly. And say, these people are not an extension of ourselves. And we have no ill will toward them, but we need to separate. And that has to take absolute precedence over everything else.
Right. And there are millions, if not hundreds of millions, of Africans who speak English these days.
Right. Right.
So that's bogus, too.
You can also find just endless instances of Africans adopting various African-American cultural phenomena. And a lot of people I encounter, they talk about how they've lived in Africa or they speak with Africans and they don't feel any affinity toward African-Americans. And, you know, I've worked with Nigerians in the United States and, you know, they all went to a local Black church and they all intermarried and they met with other Africans from the Congo. And so I just don't know where people come up with some of this stuff. It's just, it's nonsense. Africans and African-Americans, while I would argue that African-Americans do have some cultural tendencies that are unique to them. It's like, would anybody really, well, people do say this, I guess. People say, well, whites in Appalachia don't really have that much in common with whites in Great Britain. And like, I guess in a roundabout way, that's true, but just people derive this meaning from that, that I just feel like is entirely erroneous. I mean, the very first people, white peoples to inhabit Appalachia were from the British Isles. I mean, if you took your average Appalachian and you stuck them in the British Isles, I mean, they would assimilate very, very quickly. And there would be, and the fact of the matter is, your average person in Appalachia has far more in common with some rural person in Northern England than they do some guy named Tyrone in Detroit. They just, that's just the bottom line.
Yeah. And Tyrone has something in common with Blacks in Brixton, for that matter.
Yeah.
I mean, this is true. everybody I know from the United States who's gone to Great Britain has felt like they were coming home. They felt at home there, except for the fact that they drove on the wrong side. And they had a few different words for things like lift and elevator and bonnet and lorry and whatever. It's easy to navigate these things. It's easy to get over those sorts of differences very, very quickly. So, yeah, and in the end, our survival requires separation. And so even if it isn't easy for them, it's far more important for us to actually survive than for them to be comfortable. And that's just the end of it for me. You know, you can respect other people's human rights and so forth, but I'm sorry, we might have to inconvenience you in order to survive as a race. And I've got bad conscience about that.
I totally agree. And I would just add, though, that if you take the sort of bleeding heart perspective, eventually these people will collapse our societies and all the things that made them feel comfortable will cease to exist. And so, you know, either way, there's a certain amount of eventual phenomena that we're all going to have to deal with one way or another. We can deal with it humanely now by putting our foot down and being adults about it, or we can pretend that we don't have to deal with it and we can prolong the inevitable and make it 10 times worse.
Absolutely. Very well said. So I take it that you're not really rejoicing all that much about the Roe v. Wade overturn. Is this correct?
Yeah, not really. I mean, I have a lot of difficulty expressing and conveying to a lot of different people how I actually feel about it. Like, I'm with you. I find abortion to be morally reprehensible. I find it disgusting. I don't agree with it. I don't think we should really allow it, only, you know, in extreme cases such as rape, things like that. Generally speaking, it should not be what it is today. It's a cultural institution. So I'm totally, in that sense, I see the overturn as a good thing, but I just see a lot of right-wing Americans not willing to come to grips with the reality that Roe v. Wade will result in a surge in Black births. It will contribute to our demographic replacement. The overturn happened. I'm sorry, it's raining really hard here, and it's kind of hard to hear myself talk at the moment, but I'll try. So the overturn, I think, happened in conjunction with a bunch of other measures. The borders aren't getting closed. None of these other things that are contributing to our demographic replacement are being addressed. And I just don't see right-wing Americans, either in the dissident spheres or in the more mainstream spheres, really having the passion for addressing demographic replacement to the extent that they have the passion for the overturn of Roe v. Wade. I just don't think overall that it's really a win. You know, and I hear some of these pushbacks like, well, abortions are down anyway, and, you know, people are not really getting that many abortions, so it doesn't really matter. It's not really, well, then it's not, what was the purpose of the overturn? I mean, I don't know. I just don't think it's really the win that people think it is. I think people just need to focus much more on demographics.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. My attitude is that you can't morally justify abortion. I would even go so far as to say that you can't justify it in cases of things like rape and incest or getting rid of Down syndrome infants and things like that. I could even go so far as to say that. And I do not think it's, how to put it, our policy as white nationalists is not to kill off millions of our enemies because that's convenient for us, right? Liberals, apparently, want to kill off millions of unborn children because it's convenient for them. We have higher standards. However, when you look at the different demographic percentages of abortions, the truth is that there had been no Roe versus Wade, the Black population in America would be more than double what it is today. The Great Replacement would be a lot further along. And that's the thing that really concerns me the most. Now that it's happened, now that Roe versus Wade is overturned, my view is that we should enjoy the suffering, enjoy the memes. We should not spend our political capital on this, though. We didn't need to spend our political capital on overturning it. It was overturned by the conservative movement. It's the only real victory in the last 50 years that I can think of the conservative. Well, okay. The Cold War, it was their policies that won the Cold War. It was their policies that basically destroyed state ownership. You know, nobody wants to nationalize industries anymore. Not even Bernie Sanders wants to do that. So the conservative movement had some huge wins. This sort of Cold War conservatives with their free market economics, that triumphed. They triumphed over the USSR. There's no question about that. Communism is in retreat all over the globe. Socialized economics is in retreat all over the globe. The cultural conservatives did win on Roe versus Wade. Okay, but that doesn't really help the Great Replacement all that much. And my concern is that these mainstream normie conservatives are just not programmed to save the white race. They're not programmed to be concerned about our cultural and demographic decline. And they're going to be celebrating this. They're going to be struggling state by state now to overturn abortion in state after state. There's going to be a huge amount of capital expended on this. There's going to be a huge amount of debate and polarization. I just think we can't get involved in this. We should stay focused on what we want to do, which is save our race on this continent and around the world. And it would be nice if we could say, okay, you've won on Roe v. Wade. Let's take some of your energy and enthusiasm and focus on the Great Replacement. I just don't know if these people would do it. I don't know if they'd be receptive to that or not.
Well, what I see for the most part, particularly, I guess, in the mainstream, is this, you know, people post, you know, based blacks saying based things about abortion and various conservative ideas. You know, PragerU recently put out a video of Clarence Thomas saying what I think will appeal to a lot of people, like this idea that affirmative action perhaps needs to go. And yeah, I like all that, but it's like none of that's enough. I just feel like it's still not really in the collective psyche of the right wing that that we need a racial divorce, and that no matter how many different ways you try to put a Band-Aid on this or reorient people's perspectives or whatever, the race question will eventually once again rear its ugly head. Like, we are never going to get past this. We've tried to get past it for over 200 years. The founders of the United States knew that we would never get past this. Jefferson in the 1820s had a whole plan for racial separation. Everybody ignored him to their peril, to our peril. You know, I think Mark Weber, the historian, has a lot of really good perspectives on this. I feel like America, we Americans have just always had this sense of, well, we have this giant continent on which we can expand and we don't really have to worry about it. There's plenty of space we can all share. All these other peoples, they can live here, here, and here. And now we're kind of at the point where we've filled up the continent. There really isn't that much more space. And yet we still see a lot of right-wing dissidents and right-wing people think, well, I can move to Montana and start a little town there. Like, one of the things I keep hearing about is this implementation of basically we can go back to sort of free association and we can build like little Orania's and things like that in various places in the United States. And it's just like that, you know, basically what that calls for is we're going to build anew in the middle of nowhere, and we're going to concede all these other territories to everybody else. And
yeah, yeah.
That will work.
Yeah. If we had the power to build Orania's, we would have the power to just send all these people away.
Exactly.
If we don't have the power to send all these people away, then we won't have the power to build an Orania without it simply being sectioned out of existence, right? You know, refugees sent in and blended out of existence. So it's not a solution. It's the old American solution of running away from problems. Americans love to preen as brave and these colors don't run, but Americans, they always run away. They always run away because the continent's big. The whole country was populated and the whole continent was settled by people running away from their problems.
Yeah.
And it's very deep in our cultural DNA, and we can't run away from these problems anymore. Another thing that's very bothersome to me right now, because it just encourages the normie cons, is this realignment that's taking place. The left has become so toxic that POCs, people of color, are actually switching their party affiliations. Large numbers of Hispanics, especially, are switching party affiliations towards the Republicans. This just encourages the Republican crack pipe of minority outreach and so forth, the idea that they can be saved by Kanye West here and, you know, some Latina on the border becoming a Republican and all this stuff. It's really bad. It's really, really bad because we want things to be much more cleanly polarized on racial lines. And things are polarizing now on ideological lines. And it is becoming, on the right, more multiracial because the left has become so insane and obnoxious and, you know, obsessed with transsexuals and things like that, especially, that we are getting based Black and Latin people in larger and larger numbers. It just encourages these people to think that maybe we can have a workable sort of right-wing civic nationalism. The trouble with that is that that dooms our race. In fact, I would much rather have chaotic left-wing multiculturalism than a more stable, realist right-wing multiculturalism, because the left-wing multiculturalism will break down and maybe we can get rid of it. Whereas if we manage to put multiculturalism on firmer grounds with law and order and sound economic policies and things like that, that just means the extinction of our race on this continent. It'll take more time, but it'll be far more certain than if we just allowed Antifa and BLM to run the country into the ground.
Yeah, if you want a good idea of what America will look like if we embrace that sort of right-wing civic nationalism or whatever, that color, I mean, it'll look like a lot like Latin America. And I've been living down here for 10 years, and I'm telling you, you don't want that. It doesn't work. And all the race stuff will continue to exist. I mean, in all throughout Latin America, you have small, tiny white populations. You have small but notable Black populations. You have small to medium-sized indigenous populations who still speak their local languages and still are pretty much full-blooded indigenous people, and they have an indigenous local identity. And then you have this big bulk of mestizos, and all of these different groups act like big ethnic blocks, and they all have divergent interests, and there's just constant sources of tension between all of them, and they don't go away. And, you know, you might think that for a little while, you know, because Blacks don't like the constant LGBTQ+ transgender stuff, that we're all going to get along. But you can't really build an identity based on the opposition to insanity. Like, a lot of people in the dissident sphere are very hung up on Jews. And I get that. You know, organized Jewry is a big problem. But likewise, we can't build a multiracial coalition that's just anti-Semitic. You know, we can't build a collective identity on Jew hatred. We can't build a collective identity on hatred, period. We have to build an identity based off of genetic similarity and cultural similarity and heritage and history and all of that. And Maurice Samuels said in his book, You Gentiles, which he wrote in 1920s. But he said, in reference to white Gentiles, you and we may convince ourselves periodically through waves of liberality that we can bridge the unbridgeable gap and that we'll eventually get along. But he recognized that all it was a wave of liberality. And that's kind of what we're starting to see culminate now, this idea that, like, well, maybe we can get along again. And it's just, no, it's not going to work.
Yeah, I really want to poop the party that is going on the right today. There really seems to be hope in sort of boomercon multiracial civic nationalism. I don't want these people riding high. I think this is a very, very bad thing for our movement. Again, it is a greater enemy to us to have a right-wing, stable, sort of Christian-branded civic nationalism with some teeth in it, law and order, et cetera, than it is to have insane leftism and multiracialism. We have to see this. We have to make this clear to our people, because our people are inclined to think, well, maybe we can make this work. And as long as everyone's lawful and orderly and play by our rules, maybe we can make this work. But no, not in the long term. And even if it does work, it only works at sort of maintaining civility while our race declines towards extinction. And that's failure for us.
There's still a substantial amount of people who just fundamentally are radical individualists. You know, like they just really don't care about race. They don't see the utility in any kind of collective identity. And those people, I think, you know, in a per capita sense, are probably better off financially and their personal lives are a little bit more intact and so on and so forth. And they're kind of shielded from the problems that come about from diversity. And so like they just, you know, again, Charles Crocker comes to mind because he made a ton of money from Chinese immigration. He didn't care what it did to everybody else because it made him a ton of money and it worked really well for him. And I suspect that, you know, a lot of people within the right-wing sphere are kind of like little Charles Crockers. They just see that, well, you know, doesn't really cause any problems for me yet, so I don't really have a problem with it. And that's really the problem. A lot of white people aren't really going to change their mind about certain things regarding race and diversity until it's like absolutely staring them in the face and they can't escape it. The problem is, a lot of these people who keep advocating this sort of race colorblind civic nationalism, they won't be around to see it. They'll die off and it'll be their grandkids and their great grandkids and our grandkids and great grandkids who will have to deal with it. And by then, under those circumstances, it will be a lot harder to do something about it. So I don't really have a solution. I'm just outlining what I think is the problem.
I wrote this little piece about how to calm the boomers down about white nationalism, how to make boomers no longer afraid of white nationalism, because they have this terrible image of a dystopia where there are no Latins with leaf blowers or making burritos and things like that, this terrible dystopia. And if we take the sort of slow cleanse plan that I've laid out, it's taken us 50 years to get into this mess. It's now more than 50 years, but it'll take us, maybe we can spend 50 years reversing the incentives and slowly rectifying things. You just say to them, don't worry about it. You'll be dead before then, right? You don't have to worry about it. You'll be dead. So you won't have to live in a world without burritos and leaf blowers, right? That calms them right down, right? A lot of these people are shockingly selfish when you finally get them to, you know, to say, well, I'll be dead by then, so it doesn't matter to me. Well, you know, you'll be dead by the time we get our ethnostate too, so it shouldn't matter to you. So just, you know, golf or something, right? Just do, you know, golf a little extra. Don't worry about it. You'll be dead before the ethnostate happens anyway.
That's very well said. It cracked me up, but you're absolutely right. I don't have anything to add to that, but yeah, you're absolutely right.
So I have a couple questions here on entropy. Folks, if you want to send it in, it's entropystream.live/countercurrents without the hyphen. Just hit the green button, leave an offline chat. We're not streaming there, but we can take your donations and your questions there. ABC is written in with $5. Thank you. It might be a strategic mistake to focus on non-white reverse immigration, a waste of time. A better strategy might be to stop or limit new third world mass migration. Right. By the way, is democracy compatible with white nationalism? Okay, there are two questions there. Well, the first answer is this, as far as I'm concerned. Yes, if you're in a hole, the first thing to do is stop digging, right? And so the first thing that we need to do is stop the influx of non-whites, close the border, build the wall, etc. That's the first priority. However, if we do that and nothing more, we're still doomed because there are tens of millions of them here. I'm sure there have to be more than 30 million illegals alone. They're reproducing at a rate slightly higher than whites, and they are going to take over even if we don't let any new ones come in. Therefore, we have to commence repatriation. We have to close the borders first, and then we have to talk about repatriation. And Ann Coulter made me cheer a few days ago. She tweeted out, the first Republican candidate to use the word repatriation has my vote. We have to get people to talk about that. Okay, it's not the first thing. The first thing is stopping the influx, but then we have to organize the outflow. What are your thoughts on that?
Unfortunately, I don't have anything to add again. I just totally agree. There was another thought I had about something else with that question. Oh, do you want to go on to the next question? Because I did have a comment on that. Is democracy compatible with white nationalism?
Yeah, go ahead. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's totally compatible. I mean, a lot of people dump all over democracy, quote unquote, now. And obviously, all the various forms of liberal democracy we have today are a joke. You know, I think the way a lot of our founders envisioned democracy was there was this much smaller pool of very elite aristocratic individuals who would be participating in democracy. And those people would have a legitimate interest in our collective well-being. I totally support that kind of democracy. The problem is, you know, we have to replace all of the elites. But generally speaking, you know, my ideas on democracy are that a democracy only works insofar that you're actually willing to lose to the other side. And I think throughout Anglo-American history, for the most part, you know, I guess more back before from, I guess, the time of our founding up until the Civil War, we kind of were willing to lose to the other side because more or less they had the same basic set of interests. At this point in time, we can't lose to the other side. The other side is completely hostile. So, I mean, like, that really has to be your baseline criterion for a functional democracy. Both sides have to have a basic set of fundamental interests. And in this case, you know, it has to be like, collect, like, what's best for white Americans, like what's best for us as a racial ethnic group.
Yeah, I think that's well stated. I am an advocate of democracy in a qualified sense. I go back to Aristotle on this. I go back to Aristotle's Politics. I think Aristotle's Politics is one of the great works of political philosophy. In there, he outlines the mixed regime. And the mixed regime is the kind of regime that the American founders set up. Aristotle says there are three basic types of government. You can be governed by one man, you can be governed by a few men, you can be governed by many men, but you can't be governed by all men. Why? Because there are always going to be some people within a given society who are incapable of participating in government. The very young, the children, the old and senile, the insane, right? People like that. There are some people who just don't have the capacity to engage in self-government. Therefore, there are three basic forms of rule. Rule by one, rule by few, rule by many. And you can have two basic ways of having the one rule. One is what he calls monarchy, and that is one man ruling for the good of the whole society, for the common good of society, which is lawful in Aristotle's view. The highest law for Aristotle is the common good of society. The other form of one man rule is tyranny, and that's one man ruling for his own interests. You can do the same thing with rule by the few. Rule by the few for the good of all is what he calls aristocracy. Rule by the few for their own factional interests is oligarchy. And then you can do the same thing with rule by the many. Rule by the many for their own selfish factional interests is what Aristotle calls democracy. And it's very, very telling that he had to invent a new word for rule by the many for the good of all, because it was so uncommon, right? But he calls that polity. And then he basically argues that the most reliable way of ensuring justice is to have a system that has elements of monarchical, aristocratic, and popular rule mixed together. And that is really the model of the American Constitution. I think it's a brilliant model. I think it, with a few tweaks, can work. And Aristotle's case for popular government, though, is very powerful because he says that if the people are not empowered to exercise some influence on government, then inevitably there is going to be corruption. And the elites that have control over the mechanisms of government will inevitably start governing for their own interests rather than the common good. Therefore, the people have to be empowered. Now, it's very, very difficult to empower the people. There's a joke that I heard once. It's actually true, but it's very, very funny. There was this protest. I don't know what war it was. There was some war in America, and there was some campus protest, and somebody stood up and said, "What do we want?" And the crowd said, "Peace." And then the guy with the microphone said, "When do we want it?" And the crowd screamed, "Now." And then the guy with the microphone made a mistake. He said, "Why do we want it?" And the crowd was silent because, well, why do we want it? And finally somebody screamed, "Because." And then everybody started laughing because it was a joke. But the point is that when you actually get down to deliberation, right, talking about reasons for things, generally you can't just have popular acclaim, right? You can't just have people shouting out all the same reasons for things, right? It gets more complicated. But, you know, the people, when they're brought together, they can give a resounding no to something that's obviously stupid, like open borders, right? Or obviously crazy, like a lot of our policies. And the sad truth is that for all the discourse on the right that's contemptuous of democracy and elitist, the truth is that if we had absolute popular democracy in the West, where people could vote on every issue with their cell phones, right? If we had rule by plebiscites or referendums on every major issue, we'd have better government than we do with our representative elites. There's just no question about it. If the people could rule on immigration and globalization, we would have no open borders. It would have been over a long time ago. So an element of popular government is extremely important, but it's just hard to make work. It's harder to get the people en masse to deliberate, but it's very easy to get them to veto things. And they will veto things that are wrong for them, things that victimize them. And if they have the power to veto the things that victimize the majority of the society, that forces the elites to drop such stupid ideas and govern for the common good. So there's a very powerful case to be made for empowering the people. And that's what I believe in. This is why I'm a populist. I'm a populist in two senses. One, I believe in the idea of the common good, which is a principle of legitimacy. A government is not legitimate if it does not govern in the interests of the society as a whole. And I'm also a populist in the sense that the best way to ensure that a government governs in the interests of the population as a whole is to empower the people to prevent it from becoming corrupt. The trouble with liberal democracy is that liberal democracy is just a euphemism for minority rule at this point. It is a mechanism for empowering minorities to screw the majority of the people. And it's absolutely hilarious when you see these affronted minorities shrieking about Donald Trump or Brexit or Marine Le Pen, because they're almost admitting it. They're almost admitting the game is almost up. They're almost admitting that the people should have no say in how they're governed. And it's really, really fascinating to see the mask drop. I have a piece at Countercurrents called In Defense of Populism, where I have a lot of quotes from various intellectuals, you know, shrieking about Brexit and shrieking about Trump, the idiocy of the people. But even these people would not be so brazen as to deny the principle of popular government. They're not so brazen as to say, you know, to the majority in whatever country they live in, your purpose is to be our slaves. That's what they think. That's really what these people think. But they would never be so blatant about it. And the reason I gave for this is that when somebody frankly announces that they just think you're dirt and really want to enslave you for their grand designs, it's really a question of whether you should give them a counter argument or just reach for your gun at that point. These people are not so blatant. They still maintain at least verbal acceptance of the principle of popular sovereignty. And we can therefore use that, demand that they actually rule for the public good or get out of the way. And that's what we really need. We need to use the dominance of the principle of popular government to eject these elites that rule only for themselves and for global foreign interests oftentimes as well.
Yeah, like, you know, a big component here is the control of the media. I mean, if none of what you said was applicable, then they wouldn't have to censor all of us. And they censor all of us because if we're all allowed to grow organically, we grow a lot and we grow very quickly. I think you're absolutely right. And that's why censorship is sought after. And it's also why it works. I mean, a big problem is it's hard to really gauge because of the media and how it represents everything. It's hard to gauge how many of our people think A, how many of our people think B. And it kind of keeps us, I mean, at least it keeps me in a continual cloud of confusion. I have a very difficult time knowing which way the wind is really blowing in terms of how most white Americans feel about any number of issues. And I feel like to some extent that's done on purpose.
Yeah, but the number of people who believe the media is dropping. And this is one of the things that I'm constantly find myself muttering to myself. And sometimes I'll actually say it out loud to my friends who are engaged in this sort of self-indulgent blackpilling. They'll see something, a poll, you know, that 72% of people polled who are reading The New Yorker think that George Floyd was murdered. And I'm thinking only 72% of New Yorker readers believe that? I would think 92%. But they'll read polls that are basically polls of people who are media believers. And they'll get all blackpilled. And it's like, well, what about the media non-believers out there? More and more people are tuning out the media entirely now and going for alternative media and finding it. And that's really a cause for hope. In the days before the internet, yeah, total media control just meant that our ideas were out in the wilderness. But even with all of their censorship efforts, and they've thrown a whole lot of stuff at countercurrents over the years, our traffic has never been higher. Why? Because people are searching us out. They're searching out alternative views because they don't trust the experts anymore. And that's very, very encouraging. I have a couple more questions here. Archie sends in $10. Thank you so much. Tools of unification. In Israel, there have been efforts to exclude Arabs from the Knesset. Israel demands completion of military services for Arabs to get jobs in Israel. The Basic Law attempts to make Hebrew the only official language. Canada and USA waste too much time on language translation. Yeah, there are a lot of things that we could do to tighten up America to make it less desirable for these aliens who are coming in. And we could do that and fewer of them would come and more of them would repatriate. So that's a good point. Gadius writes in with $10. Thank you. Happy Independence Weekend, gents. In your opinion, what was America's finest hour? I'm just going to say this very, very quickly and then I'll pass it over to Krogan. I think America's finest hour was the labor movement. And I especially love the labor movement out in California in the 19th century that agitated for the Chinese Exclusion Act. I think that that was a beautiful chapter in American history. The movement was led, I think his name by Dennis Kearney, who was an Irish immigrant, a no-nonsense Irish union man. And he worked very, very hard to lay the foundations of Chinese exclusion. And I think it was a brilliant chapter in American history. And I look to that kind of populist, working class, race conscious movement again. I would love to see more of that. And then more broadly, the labor movement did a lot of good for Americans and the standard of living of working class people. So Krogan, what's your thoughts about America's finest hour?
Once again, I think you've basically stated my opinion for me. I'd have to agree there. I mean, again, I'll just reiterate that reading through the historical literature, it was just so wonderful to see all of these white men in government who took our own side. And I guess the only other period, maybe, you know, Madison Grant, his era, like maybe around the 1910s during the subsequent immigration commissions, he and the other people there, they really rose to the occasion once again when the immigration debate reared its ugly head once again. You know, the passage of the 1924 Johnson-Reed Act was pretty great. And that stayed, you know, in effect until, you know, 1965. So, yeah, I guess I would have to just agree with you and then just maybe add as a close second, you know, the Madison Grant era.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the Johnson-Reed Act was a great triumph of race realism and American democracy. And it basically meant that America had a white supremacist policy in place about immigration and naturalization until 1965. From 1790 to 1965, we had white supremacist policies in place in America. And America was far, far better for it. And this brief interregnum from 1965 to whenever we turn this ship around could be seen as just that, as just a historical anomaly for America. And this is one of the things that we have to fight for. We have to fight for a more realistic understanding of American history. The advocates of liberal democracy, they're telling us myths and fibs about America's founding, about its principles, about its history, to try and make it seem impossible for white men to take their own side, which they did throughout most of American history, and can do again.
Yeah, it's important to remember, I think, that people like ourselves, historically speaking, were the majority, and the people who had, like, there were crazy egalitarians back in the 19th century, as early as the 1840s. They did exist, but they were fringe. They were extremely fringe, and we always had enough prominent people, intelligent people with our type of worldview who managed to maintain power and who would advocate for our interests. And, you know, I still think that collectively as an ethnic bloc, as a racial bloc, we still have all of those people. It's just that for whatever reason, you know, they're not in power and they're not in prominent positions. I guess a big reason why they're not in prominent positions is because, you know, organized Jewry, you know, came in and basically made alliances strategically with the fringe movements. And they collectivized sort of as this anti-white confederation. And they basically over time, you know, took over the WASP elite. They ascended the ladders of power via all of the Anglo mechanisms of free speech. And then they kicked down the ladder behind them and they weeded out anybody who wouldn't play their game. And that's where we're at now. So I think, you know, we still have Jared Taylors, we still have Greg Johnsons, we still have, you know, Madison Grants and so on and so forth. But, you know, we need to get these people into power.
Yeah, yeah. I would like more power, more influence. That's the only way that we're going to win. We do have a counter elite. There's no question about it. There are very, very intelligent people on our side. The left is super boring. They're just mongoloid idiots driveling on about intersectionality for the most part. They're deadly dull and very, very petty and stupid. Academia is just filled with midwits, driveling midwits, intersectional midwits. And real thinkers are being basically weeded out or crowded out. But you know, we can create our own alternative institutions. And that's the important thing. There was a conservative movement, the post-World War II conservative movement was started in the 1950s. It created institutions like, well, it created journals of ideas. There was the National Review. Kind of hesitate to call that a journal of ideas, but technically it is. There was Modern Age. They created institutions like the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. They created institutions like the Heritage Foundation. These things grew into major institutions. And by the time Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, there was a conservative counter elite that could be brought forward to staff positions in his administration. And they did a lot. We have to give the conservative movement credit. They did win the arguments about markets versus central planning. They did win the Cold War once they put Reagan in. These were very important victories. Trump failed because there was no populist counter elite ready to take positions. There were no populist institutions. There was just sort of people like us on the internet. Yeah, greasy people on the internet with frog memes. You know, there were no big institutions. There were no think tanks and stuff like that. There are a few things that could have been burnished up. The National Policy Institute certainly had promise, but he lacked that counter elite that could come in. And we need to start building that. And one of the things we need to start building are institutions to cultivate that so that we can have influence on policy in the way that normicons have influenced policy. To go back to the Roe v. Wade thing, I do think that, yeah, what I would like to do at this point is just congratulate them on their victory and then steal as much of their energy as possible to fight the great replacement. I don't know how much that's really possible, but that's what I'd like to do. But we need the institutions to do it.
Well, in that regard, regarding the institutions, I just feel like, you know, a lot of people disagree on tiny little things about patriotic alternative or whatever. But overall, I think Mark Collett and Laura Taller and Sam Malia and that whole gang, I think that they are doing phenomenal work. And I feel like their overall model is something we Americans have to eventually emulate in some regard. The idea of getting chapters going and getting our people with very similar ideas to get into local politics. I think that the previous governor of Maine, Paul LePage, is going to run again. And I don't know everything about him, but I read enough about him to think that, yeah, we should probably get that guy to be governor again in Maine because, you know, he recognized that on some level that non-whites coming into Maine were becoming a problem. And so, yeah, we need some kind of patriotic alternative-like organization that just gets involved in every single local election, every single local political affair possible because, I mean, look at what's happening in Idaho. In some ways, it's sort of a white conservative stronghold, but then there are all these top-down efforts to bus in diversity, and our enemies are working very hard to go across the board and make all these changes to local areas. The only way we're going to be able to counter all of that effectively, I think, is if we have something like Patriotic Alternative to organize local pushback. So,
yeah, I do think we need organizations, and I do like PA a lot. I think it has good people in it. I don't see any reason why there can't be an equivalent in the United States. I do like the name Patriotic Alternative. You don't have to brand everything red, white, and blue like a lot of people might do, but you can just say patriotic. And that's fine. People know what that means. I would very much like to see an activist group like them. And what you need is you need people who are just willing to be out there under their own names, be doxxed leaders, and go from there. And so I like PA. It's a good model. I'm sure something like that will eventually start up in the United States. We did have Identity Europa, then we had American Identity Movement, then they shut down. They shut down because they had the preferences to remain anonymous, basically, and people were getting doxxed. If you can just sort of be like, if you can find 10,000 immortals who are just willing to be doxxed or just be out there under their own names, that could be the core of something very, very big in America. But until you have a certain number of people who are just willing and able to operate under their own names, it's going to be very, very difficult. The system in the UK is far more inimical to white organizing than the system is in the United States, though, and we have to remember that. So I do think they're a good model. Let me just check and see if we have any more questions, and then we will wrap up. So I'm going to check entropy again. Archie has sent in another $5. Thank you very much. Can a caste system be established in the West? Orthodox Islam and Judaism have a caste system for them and the Goyim. A caste system would help discourage immigration to white lands, but is antithetical to white fundamental values based on Christian universalism. Well, in a way, Islam is a universalist religion too, and whatever caste system in Islam is basically just the believers versus the unbelievers, which is the same distinction that you would have with Christians and non-Christians. So I don't know about your point there. Do you have any thoughts on this, Krogan?
I'm not an expert on this, but I have read a little bit about it. If you look at the initial expansion of the Arabs, the Bedouin Arabs, and the initial expansion of Islam, what you find in the literature is that, yes, they were a universalist religion, but they came from a culture that did enslave people, and they did have an ethnic preference, and they found ways to circumvent the Islamic teachings that preach things like, well, you can't enslave another Muslim. Because, you know, often they'd go into a territory and then people would just try to convert because technically you can't enslave another Muslim. So, I mean, they came up with all types of ways to circumvent the quote unquote universality of the religion. So technically you can say Islam is a universalist religion, but if you look at the peoples who typically practice it and how they lead their daily lives and how historically they led their daily lives, I don't think that they were, you know, it was Bedouin Arabs at the top, then it was Moors, and then it was, you know, everybody else. And yeah, I mean, they had a hierarchy. So I guess I can say that. The other thing, one of the things I found remarkable, again, about the 18th century American intellectuals and politicians who took up our side is they didn't want a caste system in the U.S. I mean, they said to Charles Crocker, basically what you're doing is you're turning the Chinese into an indefinite slave caste, into an indefinite labor class, and we don't want that. And Charles Crocker would say, yes, but it elevates the white man to do more intellectual tasks, and it just elevates him. And they said, no, we just fought a war to free the slaves, don't want a caste system. And I probably would need to more time to flesh all that out. But I guess I'll just say, I kind of side with them. I don't really want any kind of caste system. I just want peoples to live under their own political autonomy.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about Christopher Lash's books, and I recently wrote a review essay over at Countercurrents in two parts on his book, The Revolt of the Elites. If you look at 19th century American writers, especially writers who have been sort of cast into the darkness by the false, tendentious, liberal, Lockean, liberal democratic narrative about America's history, which is a false narrative, there are a lot of incredibly radical egalitarian thinkers in American history who were populists. And one of the things that's fascinating is you will find these discussions of, say, labor mixed up with polemics against priestcraft and standing armies, things like this. They were literally inveighing against the very idea of a standing army, a warrior caste. They thought that would be a bad thing for America. And the idea of a distinct intellectual caste that was sort of set off from society, that was leisured and, you know, experts and stuff like that, Americans instinctively revolted against that. Now, Evola would be appalled by it, but it's fascinating to see how systematic the opposition on the part of populist Americans in the 19th century was to anything that smacked of a caste system. Many people put forward public education as a radical egalitarian measure, but even more radical populists criticized it because it smacked of priestcraft, of experts in getting in charge of education and brainwashing kids. What they wanted to do in America is they wanted to take the functions associated with the first two castes, the sort of the Brahmin functions and the Kshatriya functions, warrior caste and the priestly caste functions, and democratize them, make them rights of the people, of the populace. And if you look at the first two amendments to the Constitution, what does the First Amendment do? It prohibits an established church, okay? And it talks about freedom of speech and freedom of gathering and petitioning the government. So it's an attempt to eliminate a caste of scribes, basically, and give the power of speech and deliberation and assembly to the people. And then you look at the Second Amendment. It's about the militia. It's about the right to keep and bear arms. Again, there were Americans who were absolutely opposed to the very idea of a standing army. They thought it was a tool of tyranny and imperialism. I don't think these people were necessarily wrong. And it was because of these attitudes that in the 19th century, when Europeans would visit, they would note that Americans of all standings in life, very, very poor Americans, were very, very well informed about things. They were interested in the latest science and the latest technologies. We had magazines like Popular Science. We had Popular Technology. We have this tradition of autodidacts and tinkerers and inventors in garages and stuff like that. A do-it-yourself ethos. That's part of the American ethos, and it was very much caught up with a rejection of the experts. Experts in knowledge and experts in war. So I think there's something worth revisiting about that in American history. It's not entirely bad. In fact, I think it's very, very good.
I agree with a lot of that. My thoughts just drift to how far we've fallen, and you know how things like Grammarly are, you know, just our whole social structure at this point is just all handholding, to the point where we have these apps that like basically write everything for you. And yeah, we don't really have an autodidactic spirit at all anymore. And we need to try to get that back.
We do have that in our movement. And that's one of the things that I love about it. We have all these autodidacts. We have all these self-educated people. American populism is a fascinating story. From 1820 up until the beginning of the 20th century, American politics was absolutely unhinged. It was, we had 80% participation in national elections. We had incredible polarization. We had parties marching with tiki torches, or well, torches, and mass rallies, and people intently studying newspapers. Debates were extremely long and detailed, like the Lincoln-Douglas debates. People were absolutely fanatically polarized. There were conspiracy theories running amok. There were all kinds of people who were dismissed as cranks today. Most of the great populist thinkers are dismissed as cranks by academic economists who've got something to hide, frankly. And it's interesting to see some of that coming back in America at the beginning of the 21st century, made possible by the internet, basically. The internet is the thing that allowed that underground populist stream of tinkerers and autodidacts and cranks and conspiracy theorists that the Brahmins, who took over basically starting in the 1920s, who controlled political discourse, controlled the media, and made politics incredibly boring and got the people out of politics. These people are being overthrown by a return of the American 19th century populist spirit. The alt-right isn't something new. It's something very old in America. And it's very interesting to see it come back through these new technologies. And I don't think that it can be kept down, frankly. If they could have kept it down already, they would have, I think.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I have been on a little bit of what some people would deem a black pill trip recently. And I guess I want to say publicly that I'm very confident that eventually, sooner or later, we will win. I just suppose I'm a little bit more blackpilled about the next several decades. Like, I think you're right. I don't think inevitably it can be kept down. I think a lot of the AI stuff and the idea that, like, I think big tech is actually quite exaggerated in terms of, like, how capable it really is. And you know, there was a wonderful article on your website a few months ago about like the race to beat the machine god or something. And I think that's a valid concern. But at the same time, I kind of suspect that technology is nowhere really as sophisticated as it seems sometimes. And so, you know, eventually the people in power right now will lose. But I just think there's a capacity for things to get much, much worse in the interim.
Yeah, as Adam Smith said, there's a whole lot of ruin in a nation. One of the things that's so fascinating about Adam Smith is that he was in so many ways one of the founders of modern liberal democracy. But you read Adam Smith and he'll say things like, a man without the ability to defend or avenge himself is little more than a slave. And he's talking about the right to bear arms, things like that. It's so interesting to see the discourse, even amongst liberals, about the martial spirit, about manliness, and things like that in the 18th and 19th and early 20th centuries. That's something I want to do a whole stream about someday, looking at people like Teddy Roosevelt and Oliver Wendell Holmes and William James and people like that. There are examples of that as well. But anyway, I really want to thank you for this. I think it's been a really enjoyable discussion. And I want people to know where they can follow your work, because you do a lot of good work.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate the invitation. I have an Odyssey channel. I have a BitChute channel. I have a Substack now. And if you don't want to watch my recent two-hour video about Call of Duty Vanguard, which actually has built into it an hour-long documentary about the UK race riots of 1919 and a whole segment on the Rhineland occupation by the French colonial army after World War One. If you don't want to sit through 2 hours of a whole bunch of stuff, you can go to my Substack and you can read two articles, one that just basically focuses entirely on the UK race riots of 1919 and another article that focuses almost entirely on the Rhineland occupation. And I think those are 14,000 and 6,000 words respectively or something like that. So they're pretty long, but you know, a lot of people prefer to read rather than sit through a video. But yeah, basically I just have the Odyssey. I have the BitChute. I'm on Twitter and Telegram. I'm technically on Gab, but I'm not very active there. And, you know, I have my Substack, but that's about it.
Well, thank you so much. I really have enjoyed this again, and we will definitely have you back again soon. And folks, I want to now say goodbye to American Krogan, and we're going to switch into a solo AMA.